This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The trade war. Yeah, it's back on. Plus shifting sands in the oil business and the joy of estate sales. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios at Colorado Public Radio in Denver, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. He's on assignment. It's Monday, the 13th of May. Good to have you with us. President Trump is downplaying trade tensions with China after Beijing announced higher tariffs on U.S. imports in response to those just imposed by Washington on Chinese goods. Trump said today he'll meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping next month and expects the talks to be very fruitful. Markets, though, not so sure. China's currency fell to its lowest level since Christmas. Here in the U.S., stocks were down. Remember, markets do go down. But beyond the short-term pain, there's now talk that a tense U.S.-China relationship could be the new normal, or at least the emerging normal. Marketplace's Scott Tong has more.
When tariffs broke out last fall, business professor Arun Sundararajan at NYU predicted it would last.
I'd expect that the effects of this trade war are going to last at least 10 years.
Wow. That's based on game theory, a way to test and understand human behavior. Now, according to game theory, tariffs are the normal state of things. They serve the self-interest of people and nations. And when you're in a trade war, he said today, it gets harder and harder to de-escalate.
It is more likely to happen if there is a higher level of trust between the two countries. And this is what makes me a little pessimistic.
These days, there's a broad lack of trust, says former U.S.-China trade negotiator Claire Reed at Arnold & Porter. There are spats over telecom, investments, spying. But at the center, she says, is China's tech policy.
It pours lots of government resources into selected strategic industries and really has been quite consistent about keeping their market closed to protect any of their growing national champions.
She says she doesn't expect China to change, which makes the U.S.-China trade conflict potentially intractable. And for those longing for the, quote, normal days of free trade, think again, says Harvard government professor Jeffrey Frieden.
Globalization is fragile, and it is not the normal and natural state of the world. It's something that is typically adopted by governments, and it can be rolled back by governments very easily.
If a long trade war is ahead, it wouldn't be the first time. He says the U.S. had high tariffs from the Civil War all the way to the 1950s. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The news from Amazon today might seem a little strange, frankly, at first glance. The company says it will pay current employees to quit their jobs and start their own delivery businesses. $10,000 in startup costs, to be exact, plus 3 months' pay to get up and running. Marketplace's Erica Barris takes a look now at why Amazon wants to bypass companies like FedEx and UPS and why the bosses think turning employees into entrepreneurs is the way to get there.
As Amazon grows, it's delivering a lot more packages and has pledged to get them to customers faster. So the company needs to reduce dependence on the likes of UPS, says Bill Pierce at UC Berkeley.
Basically, what they're trying to do is disintermediate UPS for that final mile delivery by establishing their own third-party logistic network that's, frankly, financially beholden to Amazon.
About a year ago, Amazon started letting would-be entrepreneurs apply to launch independent Amazon delivery businesses. Now it's extending the program to employees to grow its delivery network even more. Scott Galloway, marketing professor at NYU, says converting employees to business owners provides some key advantages to Amazon.
Keep in mind, this person doesn't show up at your cafeteria. This person doesn't submit healthcare claims. This person doesn't ever file a suit for wrongful termination.
When Amazon launched its new delivery network about a year ago, it said startup costs for things like lawyers, accountants, supplies would start at about $10,000. Dave Mawinney at Carnegie Mellon says running a new logistics business, though, isn't just about money.
These information systems take, you know, many, many, many man years to build up over time, right? Even Uber in its early days had, you know, scores and scores of programmers developing these systems that they would iterate on and improve upon.
Amazon is declining to say how many employees it expects to make the transition from employee to delivery business owner. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Apple got some bad news from the U.S. Supreme Court this morning. A 5-4 majority of justices ruled that iPhone users can go ahead and sue the tech giant on antitrust grounds over its app store. The consumers have the same complaint as some app developers, namely that Apple's 30% cut on app store purchases is too much. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
App developers want slash need to have their products in the Apple App Store because that's where Apple's customers have to download apps. John Butler is a telecom analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence.
The small guy actually has a shot thanks to the Apple App Store because they get on a platform where there are a lot of eyeballs and they get distribution that they otherwise wouldn't be able to generate on their own.
But Apple takes a cut. 30% for one-off purchases and for the first year of subscriptions. It's actually a pretty common business model, says Avery Gardner at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Think of a grocery store.
Where food manufacturers pay slotting fees to get their products on the shelf and where they pay for the right to promote their product in the produce section.
The issue here is whether that fee is unfairly high. Spotify thinks it is and has asked European regulators to look into it. Netflix doesn't allow users to purchase subscriptions through the App Store anymore. They have to go to its website. And that could be a problem for Apple and Google, which charges a similar commission for its App Store.
People don't realize how big these app stores have become and how important they are for profitability.
Ben Schachter, an internet analyst at Macquarie, says Apple would take a big hit if it had to cut its commission, say, by half.
It could impact their overall profit by somewhere between 7 and 15%. For one of the world's largest companies, that's quite a lot of money.
But he thinks that's exactly what might happen, that both Apple and Google will eventually have to cut their fees. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street? Yeah, I already gave it away, but we'll have details when we do the numbers. It's been 2 months now since severe flooding began in parts of the Midwest, threatening lives as well as farms and businesses in states like Nebraska, Iowa, and Missouri. Now those businesses are trying to recover. Tiana Yellowhair runs a tour business on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, where the floods swept away much of the infrastructure she and her community depend on.
My name is Tiana Yellowhair. Lakota people go by their Lakota name as well. So my Lakota name is Shahilawi, meaning Cheyenne woman. When the big snowstorm hit, the bomb cyclone, we had a lot of flooding as it started to warm up. A lot of people weren't able to travel anywhere because the roads were flooding over. And so that really put aside medical appointments, business, work, things like that. Our tour guide business, a lot of the destinations that we visit, they are either non-highway or they don't have pavement. And so a lot of people were starting to not book tours because they felt that we needed, as a community, regroup and figure out resources to get it back up and running. This business actually started through a high school competition that I participated in. And we had the idea to bring that perception of Lakota people, and so we decided a tour guide business. And so I entered into the contest, won the contest, and about 2 years later, the institution I won the contest with actually helped fund and start our business. We do tours called ride hop-alongs. We will meet the client or the tour group in Central Pine Ridge, the Central Pine Ridge Reservation. The reservation is very spread out, so it'll take about a typical tour is 4 to 5 hours. We'll end the tour at Wounded Knee. It's still an active cemetery today. A lot of people still bury their families and relatives there. And what they did is they actually made a fence, a chain link fence. Along this chain link fence is very powerful. Just seeing it in person, there are tobacco ties, sage, offerings left for the soul and the spirit of the people that were there. It's a powerful image to behold. A lot of people come across the perception that we are very poverty stricken, but the culture and the language is alive here. It's magnificent that they see that a people who went through so much in history are where we are today.
Tiana Yellowhair from the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Economists will tell you that inflation is barely a thing in our economy right now. The consumer price index was up just 0.3% last month. But a big part of that small increase was from rising rents. Rents nationally are up 3.8% from a year ago. And new research finds that's one reason the gap between rich and poor is growing. Here to talk about it is Igor Popov, chief economist at Apartment List, a rental listing service. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how has the housing market actually contributed to the widening inequality gap in America?
Yeah, we at Apartment List, we just released this study where we were digging into some of the numbers on this a bit. And, you know, we've known for a while that income inequality is rising really because the rich and the tip top of the income distribution is kind of pulling away from the pack. Wages are not growing quickly, but at the top, they're growing very quickly. And what we found was that housing costs are actually in some ways doing the exact opposite. The housing costs are growing fastest for those on the lower end of the income distribution, for low earners, whereas for the upper middle class and the wealthy, they're actually falling. So in this way, we're really seeing that paychecks are getting really squeezed at the bottom, and actually folks at the top of the income distribution are actually getting a little bit of a break every year on housing costs, in addition to getting this improved income.
And why is that? Why are costs growing more at the bottom than at the top?
Yeah, I think there are a number of factors at play, but I think one, you know, if you sort of imagine these two families, one at the lower end of the income distribution, one at the higher end, the one at the lower end, it's much more likely to be in the rental market, and the rental market has been getting a lot of the hits of the growing economy in terms of rising costs. For the family at the top, they're much more likely to have purchased their home. The data are showing us that those that have purchased their homes aren't moving very much compared to previous generations. So that's one of the reasons. And I think a second reason is just that there's been more supply built really at the high end of the market than we've seen supply filter down to the lower end of the market. And so folks at the top seem to be getting a bit of a break. And not just in relative to their incomes, but just in actual nominal terms.
You also found that renters at all income levels are spending more of their incomes on rent, while homeowners are actually paying less. And that's despite, you know, the housing market that we've seen just booming in the last several years with home prices growing. How do you explain that difference?
Yeah, we found that, you know, it's interesting. Renter incomes have been outpacing homeowner incomes over the past 10 years, but the rents have risen to match them, whereas homeowner costs are actually falling. And I think that we're not seeing as many people upgrade. We're not seeing as many new single family homes built. And as a result, I think more homeowners are staying put. And as rates have been climbing lower, they've been able to refinance and get better deals. Renters, of course, have not had such an option.
What do you see as the solution to this widening inequality when it comes to housing?
The real takeaway that we came away from the study with was that we've been having a policy discussion around inequality and rising inequality in the U.S. We've been having a policy discussion around disappearing housing affordability for many families. I think what we're learning is that those are really part of the same discussion. So I think knowing that that's kind of one broader issue is going to be important going forward.
Igor Popov, he's chief economist at Apartment List. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you.
coming up.
I'm just a snoop who likes other people's stuff.
Estate sales in the era of tidying up. But first, let's do the numbers. It had to be the trombones. Stocks tanked after China announced that new slate of retaliatory tariffs. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slumped 617 points, 2.3% to close at 25,324. The NASDAQ slid 269 points, 3.4% to finish at 7,647. And the S&P 500 dumped 69 points, 2.4% to end at 2,811. Boeing dropped almost 5% after the editor of the Chinese newspaper Global Times said China could single out the aerospace giant as the trade war continues. Teva Pharmaceuticals is one of 20 drug companies being sued by a group of states for scheming to inflate drug prices and quash competition from generics. Teva lost 3.3%, also named in the suit Mylan, which dropped 9.5%, and Novartis, which sank 1.7%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.40%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Oil was another market that saw prices fall today amidst increasing trade tensions with China as investors moved out of riskier assets. In West Texas, getting that oil out of the ground takes a lot of sand mixed with water to blast it from shale. And for about 60 years, companies had a go-to place, the sandy soils of McCulloch County in central Texas. But that market has been drying up. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
The sand mining industry, vital to Brady, Texas, the McCulloch County seat, is a hot topic of discussion at a public gathering on a recent weekday afternoon. Folks are here at a tractor supply store where the local farm bureau is grilling up free hamburgers. 90-year-old Louise Long is enjoying a burger with her girlfriends. She owns a real estate business in town. She keeps hearing about more layoffs at the sand mines, and she's worried.
The sand plants have been here for so long, and so many people work for the sand plants. We're going to suffer for it for a long time.
Late last year, McCulloch County had 7 sand mines in operation. Now it's down to 2. When the fracking boom hit the U.S. a couple of decades ago, with the Permian Basin in West Texas as ground zero, oil companies started using a lot more sand. And Brady Brown, as it had come to be known, was the standard. The grains of sand were strong, the right shape, and held up under the extreme pressure of fracking. But when oil prices dropped dramatically 5 years ago, companies had to figure out a way to cut costs. So they started testing Permian Basin sand, which didn't have to be trucked in from 200 miles away. Rick Eltoff used to run quality control at a Brady sand mine owned by oil company Pioneer Natural Resources.
I found the strength of it to be as good as the sand they have here. Now, it wasn't quite as round, but it's obviously working, or they wouldn't be using it.
Now, Pioneer harvests most of its sand in West Texas, saving hundreds of millions of dollars a year. The company used to employ hundreds of people in Brady, but now is just down to a skeleton crew. Pioneer says it will shut its Brady sand mine by the end of this month.
The plant I was at closed on April 1st.
That's Ryan Adams. He says he was making about $80,000 a year as a plant manager at Cadre Proppant in Brady, where the median income is about $35,000. But he quit in December to open a classic car restoration company. He saw the writing on the wall for his job at the sand plant.
They kept saying they were going to extend it for, you know, it might be July or we can run another year and all this, and I could just see through it.
He says the company offered him a $150,000 salary plus bonuses to move out to West Texas to run a sand plant there. He wasn't interested, but that's what a lot of people in Brady are doing, taking job transfers and spending half their time in the Permian. The closure of the sand plants in Brady extends far beyond the mining industry. Sherry Talley used to run the books for Texan Truck Wash, which cleaned a lot of 18-wheelers that hauled sand out of Brady. It had to close a few weeks ago.
When you rely totally on truck traffic and you've got so many sand plants that have closed, we just couldn't do it.
Talley's lived in Brady for more than 20 years and says she couldn't imagine the sand industry not being here. She says a lot of people have had to cut back on spending.
You don't just go out to eat and everything all the time like you did. I feel sorry for the merchants here, but what do you do?
She expects more businesses, especially retailers, will have to shut their doors soon. Local officials are debating whether to offer tax incentives to lure other businesses to Brady. Mayor Tony Groves says the town could rebrand itself as a hill country tourist destination, a place for a little R&R for people from Dallas and Houston.
Instead of being a mining town, is it potential that Brady becomes the stress elimination center for this part of Texas?
Right now, Brady is nothing but stress as jobs keep moving west. Just this month, two companies have announced further layoffs, and more are expected to come. In Brady, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We've talked before on the show about the latest phenomenon to hit home improvement, tidying up, the method from decluttering guru Marie Kondo. She helps people organize their lives by only keeping things that, as she puts it, spark joy. Well, one way things can spark joy is with the stories of where they came from. Anne Friedman is a journalist and co-host of the podcast Call Your Girlfriend. She's also a huge fan of the estate sale, which she describes as a going out of business event for one person's life and the perfect hobby for storytellers. She recently wrote about the magic of estate sales for Curbed. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. So how did you get into this estate sale business?
This has been a hobby since I would say my teen years, when I would get on my bicycle and go to garage sales and yard sales for fun. So maybe I'm just weird. I don't know. This has been a forever hobby for me. I'm just a snoop who likes other people's stuff.
And you sort of build a fantasy about the people who lived there, but you had an opportunity to kind of see how different the fantasy was from reality. Talk about Joe's house and finding sort of what you call the holy grail of estate sales.
Well, typically what happens is I am alone with my story, right? You know, I kind of say, oh, you know, this person was a world traveler, but they clearly had trouble traveling, and here's their Dramamine stash, or whatever, you know, tiny snippets of stories.
That would be my house.
Right, yeah. The special thing about this sale that I went to late last year is that the home still had a couple photos in it. It still had a couple of funeral memorial booklets, so, you know, actually this person's name and a few details about who they were. And I'm not like an obsessive stalker. I'm really more trying to entertain myself.
Right.
You know, I had put together this story about how he was a gay man who had come out late in life. And it turned out that his surviving husband had several years prior written a memoir about he and Joe falling in love. And so I had this shockingly complete story, which that is when I thought, you know, maybe this is the time that I actually write about why I love estate sales, because this is such a rare and wonderful thing to get my own story fact checked.
It was a beautiful story of these two men who did come out late in life. Each of them had been married to women and then found love together. And it seemed like it was a happier story in reality than maybe you had imagined.
I had some generational stereotypes maybe about what their lives had been like, or how accepting their families had been of their relationship. And, you know, it really turned out that everyone, you know, both of their prior partners, all of their children, everyone was really just quite thrilled for them. And it's just a reminder to me of why, in fact, I do like meeting strangers and talking to them, is because the reality is always more complicated than the story that you've told yourself about it.
We're in this really interesting cultural moment surrounding our stuff with the rise of Marie Kondo and tidying up. Has all this snooping made you think differently about your stuff?
Sorry, I'm thinking about that one.
Good.
I mean, it feels new, particularly with Marie Kondo's work, that people are talking about the value of somewhat mundane stuff in a different way. You know, and I've often thought about if I were to undergo the tidying up process, going through my whole house to see whether every item sparked joy, I would end up having to buy a lot of new stuff, right? I mean, I hate my garlic press. It never quite worked
left.
Right.
Do,
right, do I need a new garlic press? Like, no, I don't. Like, everything that doesn't fully live up to the joy sparking ideal still has value based on the fact that you're using it every day. And it's not only things that someone has deemed valuable or heirloom quality.
Ann Friedman wrote about the magic of estate sales on Curbed. She's a writer and host of the podcast Call Your Girlfriend. Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure.
This final note, which could save you a lot of money at the neighborhood coffee shop. A study in the journal Consciousness and Cognition suggests that just thinking about coffee can make you more productive, at least if you're from a culture that associates coffee with alertness. When given cues related to either coffee or tea, participants from Australia and Canada had better mental focus from coffee-related cues. Those from tea-drinking cultures like China, Korea, and Japan saw no effect. Researchers say it'll take larger studies to confirm the connection. But the next time you're in an afternoon slump, what's the harm in trying it? I did. I don't think it worked. That's it. We've got to go. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average slumped 617 points, 2.3%. The NASDAQ fell 269 points, 3.4%. And the S&P 500 lost 69 points, 2.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. And I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.